Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Hello, everyone, and again, welcome to another awesome and amazing Behavioral Health Integration episode. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. Bishoy Gubran. Dr. Bishoy is a psychiatrist who specializes in child and adolescent psychiatry. He is a fellow physician at Rush University Medical Center with a postdoctoral clinical research training in behavioral and cardiovascular medicine. In this episode, we will discuss many different aspects of psychiatry as to the profession itself, diagnosing particular disorders, and medication management. So without further ado, let's begin. Well, Bishoy, thank you so much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Jacob, for having me.
So just right off the bat, what really motivated you to become a doctor?
Well, to be totally honest, I'm from Egypt. I was born in Alexandria. Wow. So in Egypt, it's one of two professions are the ones that you are go-to. As in, your parents will be proud of you if you go to either be a doctor or an engineer. So these are like the top two. Mm-hmm. Lawyer, for example, are not perceived as high in Egypt for some reason. And you know that these heuristics are mm-hmm. and categories are more of a cultural point of view. Mm-hmm. So initially, what attracted me really to medicine was the perception, the cultural perception of medicine. Okay. I think I was too young to explore and introspect into what I really want to do. And I had so many sporadic interests like philosophy, spirituality, reading about physics. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know really which direction to take. Both of my parents were engineers. So yes. I thought, you know what? I would love to go to a field that is slightly different. It sounds fun. Everybody seems like it's high it gives you higher prestige in your country. So that's what initially gravitated me to medicine.
I'm curious. I don't know if Egypt's like other countries too, like over in Asia or Mexico, but is there a lot to do with like certain classes where it just sucks where if you're part of a lower socioeconomic system, you don't have the same opportunities to go to school as, let's say, a higher level, right?
Correct in a way. There are private universities, mm-hmm. but what's good about Egypt is medical school, for example, the one I went to is a public. It's one of the universities that are subsidized by the government. Okay. So I got really high scores that allowed me to enter this university, which was basically for free. And the full tuition for the 7 years of medicine was for free. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. So you went to medical school in Egypt, right?
Right.
Then what brought you to America?
Oh, so synchronicity, coincidences, and great luck. So I got the green card by lottery, which is an extremely low possibility, an extremely low chance. And that prompted me to come. I've always knew that I would love to explore the medical field and live ultimately mm-hmm. Somewhere other, live abroad and practice abroad, because I always wanted to be in touch with, you know, the latest of research and the state of the art facilities and mm-hmm. and practice the, you know, evidence-based medicine. And unfortunately, I felt like that room wasn't really available with as much opportunities in Egypt. So I was pursuing that. So I started traveling, but to Europe, different places. But eventually, when I got the green card, that prompted me to come to the U.S. by lottery, which I applied to. And now I'm a proud citizen. So it's amazing.
So does the United States look at other medical schools differently? As in, did you have to do extra work to become a doctor here in America?
In a way, IMGs or international medical graduates, I mean, naturally, you want to, if you're a program director in any program that's accepting applicants, you want to make sure that they are not only assimilated with the culture, but they're also very well understanding of the nuances of the US medical system, which is can be totally different and, in fact, is very different than practice in other countries. So you firstly do the medical license examinations, et cetera. But also you want to do a lot of US clinical experiences because that allow you to interact with teams, integrate with them, understand the flow of work, and show yourself as an active and a good participant in this team. Therefore, you're on par with the graduates here, and then you can prove yourself and join the system.
Okay, that's awesome. So when you're in med school, obviously, like after the first 4 years, you take an exam. I think it's called like the MISLs or something, or.
No, it's very different in Egypt, the system.
Okay.
So yeah, it's very different. The flow of the years is very different. Yeah.
So you choose like a specialty, right? And again, what made you choose psychiatry, especially like adolescents and children?
Yeah. So child and adolescent psychiatry is a fellowship that is done after. It's an extra specialization after you're done with general psychiatry. So, board certified in general psychiatry, and then you want to do more specialization in child and adolescent, and therefore you join a fellowship. What attracted me to psychiatry is so many things. One of them is that I really was, growing up, I was a little bit of an introvert. So I spent a long time really reading about philosophy, spirituality, human nature, psychology. I delved into Carl Jung, Freud, also philosophers, German philosophers, and different types of theology and religious texts. And all of this was making me insanely curious about what is this phenomena that we call the mind, and what is the reason for our existence? What is the meaning making? How do we make sense of things in this on this Earth, and how do we make sense of our reality? And that was my like interest. And then as I studied medicine, I loved mechanistic medicine. I loved the whole idea of really tapping into all of these labs and know the biomarkers and going. But there was something so subtle about psychiatry, something intangible, something that is ambiguous about it that attracted me to the mystery of the human mind, and felt that I can, this fits all my ontology, all what I've been building through all of these interests that I was just having that self-directed motivation to read about and to understand, made me so curious about psychiatry when I was exposed to, and to understand it further. And that's what initially attracted me to psychiatry.
It's interesting too when it just seems like you're very passionate about all of this, especially when it comes to like therapeutic approaches and whatnot. Like growing up too, and especially being in the mental health addiction field, we kind of hear of like two psychiatrists in America. Maybe other places feel this way too, but there's like the psychiatrist that prescribes medications, but also actually tries to do some type of therapy, like therapeutic approach, like again, like Carl Jung, Freudian, free association, person-centered. And then you have like the psychiatrist that prescribes medications and maybe meets with you for like 5 minutes. Does that make any sense?
I understand that these are like in the bell curve of normality of psychiatrists. We have so many extremes, and then we have the central tendency, correct? So there is definitely on the right tail of the bell curve someone who's just prescribing medication and meeting with you very efficiently to just prescribe and then outsourcing therapy. as in, recommending therapy. And then you are meeting with your therapist for the therapy. And on the left arm, and you will be surprised to find that there are a lot of psychiatrists that actually love doing therapy.
Okay.
I'm actually one of the psychiatrists that do enjoy and love the psychotherapy component. And I feel that I cannot divorce my prescription from the therapy. I feel like I cannot have an encounter without marrying both of those elements in order to infuse the state, the change of states that I want to do, whether it's psychopharmacologically or using the intervention of psychotherapy. That change of states is accelerated, augmented, and by the synergistic effect of therapy and medications. And what I believe, but that's my own anecdotal belief, is when both of these techniques are done by the same person, it activates more so of the placebo, activates more of that conviction, of the certainty of the patient that they will improve using the medication, which is extremely important in psychiatry, where so many of our diseases are placebo prone to start with, meaning that they improve with placebo so much that some of our medications sometimes fail to separate from placebo statistically.
I have another quick question. Like, have you ever worked with adults, or has your career mainly been with kids and adolescents?
Yeah, no, I worked with adults, and I worked with adults most of my career because it's the 3 years of residency is adults and psychiatry, adults in general. And then the child and adolescent part is the extra specialization that I loved. And I still can work with adults, but there is something about serving this type of population with their specific nuances and treating the family unit as a whole that attracted me to child and adult. It's much more complex, but besides being more complex, I mean, I know that complexity is subjective. I think that doing a small change when you're at a child life, at a child psychology, you definitely change a lot of their trajectory in life. You make a big difference in how, just by the mere fact of probability across the years of their extended age, that if you do an intervention really early on, you're really affecting the trajectory so much. So that's part of what I loved about child and adolescent psychiatry, that feeling of actualization, that we really can do so much of the difference that way.
I got to ask you another question to piggyback off that. Let's say, like, you're working with a child, right? Do you ever get situations where, like, parents will bring their kids in and they're like, hey, you know, his teacher said this or that, or he's super hyper, he can't focus, and could you please put him on this prescription? And you maybe have a disagreement with the parents?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. How do you handle that?
I think, firstly, it's a great assumption to feel that the parents have the best interest of their children always in mind. So I know that they're coming from a good place. That's a good assumption, because it's a safe assumption to start with.
You hope.
And then you, and then you are, you want to educate the parents about what are the symptoms of the disease that they're talking about, and then how we can really inform our decision so that we are actually knowing what we're treating and not having a contradictory effects. I think education is a big part of it. Education about what they are wanting to treat. Like, for the example you used, Jacob, which is, I think you were alluding to ADHD, which is extremely common presentation. It has to be in two settings, for example. So we'll have to get some scales from school and scales from the parents and assess those scales. And then we are also observing them during the clinic visit. We are doing a very specialized approach to history taking in order to gauge whether that is true ADHD or this hyperactivity or opposition or aggression or whatever we are seeing could be part of a manifestation of something totally different. Mm-hmm. So that's when you want to zoom out, look at the patient as a whole, look at the presentation that the parents are saying, and really absorb in the whole experiences, void of any, you know, prejudices, mm-hmm. and not be optimizing your biases to satisfy the parents, because you are always loyal to the patient and the patient is a child. And yes, you are treating the whole unit, but you are wanting to the best interest of your patient who you're advocating mm-hmm. for. Sometimes parent management training or psychosocial or executive functioning training would suffice to help many of the conditions. But then if medications are, you know, are the route that will help them, then I definitely go for the medication and advocate for that and talk with them about it, talk about the side effects, talk about the possible benefits, talk about what are the guidelines, what are the evidence-based, mm-hmm. and what do the studies tell us. And therefore, they will have an informed decision and consent when they are actually understanding the whole situation. And I think one of the key components is to really show the parents that you're aligned with them mm-hmm. in their goal to help, you know, furthering whether it's academic progress or their quality of life or the quality of life of the patient or all of these in combination, and do that in an aesthetic way and in a very artful way so that they don't feel that you're against them. They mm-hmm. feel that you're just trying to reach what they want to reach, but in a very informed way so that we are not getting, targeting something that is not right.
Because again, there's so many factors that you as a doctor may not know, especially kind of like what's going on in the home life. Because again, I don't know how often this happens, but maybe you just get parents who are just really tired and they don't want to deal with their child and they'd rather put them on medication, have them sit in front of the TV and kind of numb himself out.
Right, right. And that's where we teach parents, give them the support first, because a lot of parents are, it's very exhausting endeavor to have a child. Mm-hmm. And for somebody who never had a child, they will face all of these new labor intensive tasks daily. And they do it with love, but there is definitely an element of burnout to the parents, and the resilience are different depending on their own upbringing, their own parenting, their own socialization, their own psychological makeup. So giving support to the parents so they feel that somebody is with them is something that I felt is of crucial importance. That, hey, we are with you, we are aligned, we're going to work mm-hmm. on this. There are solutions. These are the things we're going to try. And if these didn't work, then we can try something different. And showing them the approach and showing them the roadmap to hope so that they feel encouraged by that hope theory and mm-hmm. and feel actually that there is that support system, which is extremely important, given that the parents are on the top of the, you know, quote unquote, mm-hmm. the food chain of the home unit, of the nuclear family unit. So you want to give them that support and education and resources. That can help them in this endeavor.
Then, like going back to, let's say, the ADHD, they may be looking for, say, hypothetically, like a stimulant, like Adderall, Vyvanse, whatever. Like, would you ever try to give them like an alternative type medication, like a non-stimulant?
Yeah, this is a very case by case basis. Mm-hmm. We have to see the case, the whole presentation of it. What are the comorbidities, meaning mm-hmm. what are these other psychological or neurological or medical diseases that are coinciding? We have to look at the vital signs, so the blood pressure, the temperature, all of these things. Mm-hmm. We have to look at the weight. We have to check the appetite. It's just to choose a medication is almost an algorithm where you go through so many inclusion exclusion criteria until you find the medication that you feel, given evidence, would work the best. And given the guidelines, what would work the best? And usually in ADHD, we have different medications that are FDA approved, but also the approach of trying which medications work for what specific nuance is important. Psychiatry is very personalized, is very precision, like based on the exact presentations that's right in front of you. So there's no, you know, one size fits all. It has to be very personalized and it has to be directed based on the presentation after really collecting so much data and so much information so that you are giving that informed decision.
Yeah, the reason I kind of bring up the stimulants because I work at an adult treatment center, outpatient, and a lot of the times, like a lot of my clients would be addicted to Adderall. So 9 out of 10 times, they always get switched to Strattera, which is, again, is a non-stimulant ADHD medication. So yeah, that's why I bring that up.
Yeah, and that risk is present in some of our medications, whether like stimulants or benzodiazepines or these classes. Some classes of our medications can be a little bit create dependence. Mm-hmm. However, it depends also on how much they are being monitored, how well the dosing is. Because if you are using it for something, your diversion, you're abusing the medication, then you can abuse really any of the medications. And therefore, you know, if you have the addictive pathways, patterns in your behavior, we might choose something else other than stimulants or use a stimulant mm-hmm. that doesn't give you that high or that initial increase in the mood or energy and that's all part of the factoring in of the presentation and the regular follow-ups and checking for any form of somebody using the medication more than they are intended to. And these are controlled substances. So even the prescription of them has to be very calculated and being monitored by, you know, the agencies.
Yeah, you make a lot of really good points there and everything. And yeah, it's definitely a huge topic. And yeah, like this is what really interested me too. Like, so what you just said there is like, they get energy, right? They get like a euphoric kind of like focus, right? Is that what you're kind of getting at?
Yeah, they help you if you have true ADHD. And
isn't that a good thing though, right? That's a good thing.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing that you feel more focused with it when you're having that mm-hmm. ADHD, that it helps calm those impulsivity, because a lot of ADHD has poor impulse control, low frustration tolerance. Mm-hmm. So that would assist with these things, or the hyperactivity. If they are the hyperactive type or the combined type, then they will have that fidgety nature, hyperactivity part. So it definitely does those things. And that's when it's indicated. However, if anybody is abusing the medication, then it can give them they're using it either for extra high or for that increased energy it can give you, or for increased alertness and focus. When you don't have a true ADHD, then you can develop dependence on it and develop that form of addiction.
But isn't there this all like another factor we need to consider, as in maybe their dose is just too low for them?
That is a possibility.
They need a higher one.
Right. That's a good possibility. And that has to be communicated with the psychiatrist that's following up or the physician that's following up with them. Hey, we don't feel that the dose is lasting us enough. Oh, let's look at the extended release formulation, for example. I don't feel like the dose is enough. Like I feel, let's increase it a little bit. And we increased it and it's not working. Maybe let's switch it. So let's go for another type of medication. Then, again, every neurological system and every body is so unique that they respond differently to medications. And there is definitely that bell curve, but we have to be very personalized in our approach.
Can I tell you about an experience I had when I was working at an adolescent treatment center? I was a tech, so yeah. I was giving out the meds to the teenagers that were in treatment. And again, like I know doctors are very educated in the human body and how medications affect the body and everything. And what you mentioned earlier, okay, like the size of, let's say, the adolescent, his genetics and the fact that how they take in the drugs, like how long does the drug last in their system? But I swear to you, all that is holy. This one teenager, he was probably, he's in really good shape. He's probably like 5'11", lean, muscular, great shape, you know, kid. He was prescribed 40 milligrams of Adderall XR in the morning, afternoon, and at night, like at 6 p.m. Again, I'm not a doctor, but that seems a little high. You're speechless, right?
No.
I swear to God, that's what he was getting.
Yeah, no, I believe you, but I... For the purpose of this interview, I really don't want to, you know, comment on dosing or who is, you know, if this is right management or wrong, because I don't know the specific cases and I don't know what's the, you know, I just feel that overall stimulants are excellent medications when indicated and when provided with the supervision of a psychiatrist or a physician. And that's monitoring the dosing, monitoring the blood pressure, monitoring the appetite, the sleep, all of these things in order, and monitoring the symptomatology in order to make sure that the dose is the right dose and that it's not affecting the person negatively. Mm-hmm. And but stimulants are one of the most powerful tools we use. And however, when done with a clear indication that is true, and that is helping the patient function better without creating the cost benefit analysis, without creating that so much cost or side effects where it's acting more of a detriment.
Mm-hmm. And a little side note too, I'm actually on Adderall. That's why I'm kind of interested in like.
Oh, okay. No, I understand. Yeah. No.
I'm just curious. Like, is there like a guideline of like a max dose you can give Adderall, or is it solely based on just the doctor's belief and their due diligence?
No, there are maximum dosages, but it depends also on multiple factors. And I think that there are ranges that every physician know how to increase the increments and what is the maximum per day. For that, and depending also, the reason why I don't want to give a concrete answer, Jacob, is because let's say that your kidney function is not functioning well, then you would need to have a renal dosing for it. As in, you would want to make sure that you are trying to avoid it in certain GFRs that is very low. The GFR is glomerular filtration rate. That's part of the kidney functions. However, again, all of these you know, exceptions or nuances or all can have an override if the physician feels that given the overall impression cost benefit, it's much better, and given the standard of care. And
okay, excellent. So going back to like the child and adolescent question, just you as a psychiatrist, do you notice, and I'm just not just saying you, but just in the general field, that there's like a, how do I say this? A disorder that gets diagnosed like the most with kids? Like overly diagnosed? Like a disorder, let's say depression, anxiety. Is there a common theme?
Well, anxiety is one of the most common disorders that we see, because anxiety is a label that stems from so many of other disorders. ADHD can manifest like anxiety. Mm-hmm. Depression can coincide with anxiety. Mm-hmm. Bipolar can have the anxiety component. You know, most of our disorders, even psychosis and psychosis spectrum, does coincide with that anxiety. And therefore, anxiety is kind of like a common link in so many of the things we're seeing. And you know, some we see all types of anxiety disorders, whether it's obsessive compulsive, generalized anxiety, panic disorder, yes, panic attacks, etc. And so there is anxiety seems to be one of the major presentations, also because of its overlap and being coincidental with so many of other disorders. Plus also just the, you know, what they call existential angst, okay, the anxiety of just being, you know, in the day-to-day life and the oscillations of, you know, the school for children, the worries about their academic progress and whether what college will they go to, all these questions create a lot of anxiety for this age groups in specific.
Especially, do you agree with like social media too? It's like rampant nowadays compared to like 20 years ago.
God, yeah, that's a great point, Jacob. It's social media, how they compare each other, compare their progress with other, you know, children and adolescents, and how they, you know, it just puts a lot of load on them to specifically. It increases things like this comparison can trigger things like, oh, I want to be thin like this model, I want to be looking like this person, and all of these can create so much tension that can lead to maladaptive behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we were talking earlier before the show about the documentary Prescription RX, and here's my issue with it. I liked it, but in documentaries like that, they're never going to show the positives to the other side, where generally like this documentary was out to make a lot of psychiatrists look bad and saying they overprescribe medications. And a lot of the points they were like trying to make, and some of them could be truthful, where there's two examples. One was the psychiatrist gave an example of Becky, and her best friend was her neighbor named Ashley, and Ashley and her family had to move away. Becky's really sad and depressed. Okay, let's give her antidepressants. When the psychiatrist was just like, no, you don't do that. You just need to understand and accept, like, that's a part of life. Yes, it is sad. You lost your friend. She moved away. But that is a part of life that we as human beings need to get through and, you know, learn a lesson from it and not go to medications. Things like that.
Yeah, and this is where psychiatric assessment will come in handy to see most of our disorders can be triggered by stressors, can be triggered by trauma. And it's not in a causal factor where this causes this, but it can even unmask epigenetically the changes that would lead to the unfoldment of one of those disorders or the other. Now, there are so many of our disorders that can describe things like what you said. If somebody is adjusting to a change, that would be an adjustment disorder.
Yep.
Versus if it doesn't meet criteria for major depressive disorder. So if you look at our DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the book by which we go through the criteria in order to diagnose, there is always if it is not better explained, that's one of the criteria. If it is not better explained by, and then they will tell you what it's by. And therefore, if you are really engulfing all the situation and zooming out and really experiencing what are the multifaceted presentation you're having, then more often than not, you will land on the truth. It's very difficult to land on the truth because it's so ambiguous.
Yes.
But that process of disambiguation, creating clarity out of all of these sporadic data and creating that, having the curiosity to ask the right questions and to direct the interview in a way that you are really trying to target and not trying to accustom an a priori designed impression into the symptoms and therefore have a confirmation bias. That is the art of psychiatry.
Can I tell you, like, as therapists, like in a treatment center, our biggest issue when it comes to diagnosing is psychosis like symptoms. Let's say they're getting off like methamphetamine. I'm sure you know a lot about this. They could go through like a psychosis period that, from what I hear, could last over a month. So it makes it almost impossible to give them a proper diagnosis because of all the symptoms overlapping.
If it is a substance-induced disorder, whether it's a substance-induced psychosis or substance-induced, and then whether you can specify whether it's like in the withdrawal phase or whichever, what is prompting that manifestation, and then treating it. And that's the most important thing. It's just like if you are targeting something and you're observing something, it's easy to get lost in what is the label. And which category I want to put this under, which is important. But I feel that it's also okay to have 4 or 5 differential diagnoses in the beginning.
Yeah.
And meaning 5 possible diagnoses or 5 working diagnoses, with and you arrange them in the pathway of what you really think this is, and mm-hmm. then what it could be, what are the possible comorbidities, and what is the coinciding medical issues. And to be honest, that's why I'm not mm-hmm. sure if you're familiar with DSM-4.
Not so much, because when I was going through grad school, DSM-5 somewhat just came out, and then the TR just came out as well now.
Right.
But the axes, right? Was there axles or axes?
Exactly. That's what I wanted to point towards.
I never understood system. That. Maybe you could help me. What was that really about?
Well, multi-axial system was that it's trying to show you that the disorders, which is still happening now, but that there is a personality component for the presentation. There is a medical component for the presentation that you're seeing. So they divided it to axis 1, 2, and 3, and that was the way to show what is the overall presentation. The axis 1 would be the clinical disorder, axis 2 personality disorder, and axis 3 would be the general medical condition, and 4 was the psychosocial and environmental problem. And I think there was a 5. And
so would you leave the second axis blank if they didn't have a personality disorder then?
Yeah, or yeah. Put in it what you... I think Access 5 was global assessment of function, but sorry, but I was just trying... It signed up. I would leave it. Or put what you want to rule out, mm-hmm. what you are suspicious of, if it's this. But the reason I'm saying I'm missing that multi-axial system is because it really helped you navigate things in an organized mental way, where you are really trying to put those layers into your impression of the patient, and it kind of forces you to think of it that way, forces you to systematically think of it that way, and that creates that advantage. So it was, in my opinion, and I mean this is also very controversial, mm-hmm. but in my opinion, it was helping in creating that systemic approach. Which is still you do, but I think there was something about the nuance of having that multi-axial system that gave you that liberty to understand the personality organization over which the disorder is flourishing from or rising from. It's kind of like give you that visual for it.
Why do you think they got rid of it, in your opinion, if you don't mind asking?
I don't know the specifics of why. It's just... when the DSM-5 was done, I don't know. So the true answer is I don't know why they got rid of it. DSM to be done is have a revision group that is from a certain university or a certain group, where they all collect and propose some advantages, mm-hmm. propose some modifications for it. But in reality, I don't know the specific reasons of why they did that change.
Don't like a bunch of psychiatrists get together, or a lot of psychiatrists take votes on like what they want changed in the DSM? Like, oh, we want, like, let's say a new disorder, sex addiction, and they kind of vote on like a new disorder. Like, okay, this will now be a new disorder in the DSM-5, along with other procedures and so forth.
Yeah, I think there's a pathway for psychiatrists to show what they have been seeing more. And mm-hmm. There's also the evidence-based approach of the case reports and whether there's consistency in that. And the group that is creating the DSM would consider all of these commentaries while they're developing those modifications.
Okay. Yes. So I just have to... I want to go in a different direction too, but like from your experience... working with kids or adults, what do you think is like the most difficult disorder to diagnose?
That is a difficult question, Jacob, because I don't
I can tell
think...
you mine.
Oh, yeah, you can go ahead.
Bipolar, only in the sense of, well, again, because when we get referrals at a treatment center, we get DAs from like medical doctors or other therapists that will combine bipolar with so many other disorders, which could contradict each other. So like, let's say if you have like bipolar one with major depression, well, you have to understand like in certain manic phases, your mood can go like up or down for like a week or so. And there's so much to like consider. So they kind of contradict each other in that sense. But...
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. Bipolar can be a challenging diagnosis. So can be any other diagnosis, to be honest. That bipolar, of course, I can see where you're coming from, giving the manic symptoms, what are the hypomanic symptoms, and mm-hmm. whether the mixed feature pathway of like sometimes depression can present with mixed feature and have some and vice versa. So that makes it a challenging diagnosis, one that you really need to tease out. And sometimes it's difficult to understand or realize because so many would present first time with depression and not present with a full blown, you know, mania or hypomania, which is the upward pole of the bipolar presentation. But for me, in my experience, I found that it's the challenging. Every diagnosis is challenging until proven otherwise. Even the bread and butter of psychiatry, even the, you know, the straight out major depression disorder, it's challenging because it's the nuances of the individual presentation has to be so considered in order for you to target that in a good way. So sometimes depression could be, as you know, a sign mm-hmm. from another medical issue. So you can easily diagnose depression, but then you have not realized it's due to a medical condition that's underlying it. So that's why I'm saying that the complexity of each diagnosis is there because you're dealing with a new human being. Mm-hmm. And it would be... in my perspective, limiting for me to feel that there is one diagnosis that is challenging or difficult to diagnose versus the other, because that would sort of assign more salience to that diagnosis in my mind, mm-hmm. where I'm just like trying to watch out for it much more versus really tackling every case as the challenging complexity of a full blown neurological system in front mm-hmm. of you with a full life and these and the nuances of their experiences in order to reach the right diagnosis and the provisional diagnosis and the working diagnosis as well.
Well, another aspect you have to consider too is the client being truthful. How many times can a client go online and let's just use PTSD as an example, like learn the symptoms and memorize that and then go in an assessment kind of explaining your emotions that can be connected to, again, symptoms to PTSD.
Right. And that's something that could happen. And whether it's a, you know, malingering, like you're saying, or someone who is, you know, having that sick role, longing to have that sick role, which we call it factitious disorder, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes just the confirmation that people feel something and then they go over the internet and then they have suddenly feel and somatize all of these symptoms, especially if they do have high levels of anxiety, then it's easy for them to misinterpret their somatic experiences, their mm-hmm. normal interoceptive somatic experiences into something that's, you know, confirming what they're reading. So, and then, we do have scales that can show us biases, yes. that PCL. Can show us a certain level of when somebody is trying to push for a diagnosis. We have scales that even show when there is a bias from parents to show that their kid has ADHD because mm-hmm. they read about it or the teacher, because these scales are done by psychologists that have done so many nuanced questions that really tackle that.
I hear about the teacher example so many times where like a kindergarten teacher will tell the parents, oh, daughter has ADHD, and then they go to the doctors. It's
And I feel that it's good for the teachers to voice their concerns. And even if they do go to the doctor is the one that would really tease out whether that's, a true ADHD case. And then it needs to be treated with medication and treatment intervention and whatever approach that they will take. Or it's just misperception by a teacher, or misperception by the parents, or a bias because they've seen somebody else before. So it is important to allow that channel of communication between teachers and parents where they are voicing their concerns. But at the same time, it's important for the physician to take things with a grain of salt, to be not skeptical, but to want to disambiguate all of these things and reach the reality of what is going on in that neurological system that's presenting, and therefore prescribe and advise for the best intervention.
So I got to ask you something really cool. Have you seen the Johnny Depp Amber Heard court case? Or have you heard of it?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Oh, you need to check out. It was so cool in a therapeutic, interesting type of way. Obviously, it's a sad situation, but like on each team, so Amber Heard had a team of psychiatrist and a forensic psychologist, and Johnny Depp had a forensic psychologist and a psychiatrist, right? Mm-hmm. So the forensic psychologist diagnosed Amber Heard with histrionic personality disorder.
Okay.
And then Amber Heard's team is arguing that Amber Heard had PTSD from Johnny through the abuse she experienced. So it was very interesting. It was like a therapeutic warfare between the two psychologists, where the forensic psychologist on Johnny's side had a rebuttal the psychologist from Amber Heard saying, like, hey, like, she does not have PTSD. These are the reasons why. And she goes really in depth into the scales of the personality test that she gave Amber Heard to illustrate, okay, she's over emotional when she gives this answer. That's a sign that she's like faking or not telling the truth. So then it was Amber Heard's forensic psychologist's turn to back herself up and debate, like, no, this is why it's PTSD. And she gave all the exams she's done. And she's pretty much trying to say that the other psychologist doesn't know what she's talking about. It was a very interesting. I'll have to send you the YouTube videos.
Yeah, please do.
there's this guy, a psychologist in Seattle, who he's a doctorate in LMFT, licensed marriage and family therapist. He's very good, and he does reaction videos. So from a therapeutic sense, he's explaining both the psychologist's viewpoints and the psychiatrist's viewpoints.
Interesting.
Too. Oh, it's very interesting. He's like, oh, this is very interesting to see two psychologists. It's like I just battle each other in mental warfare.
Right.
It's very intriguing.
Yeah, which is not uncommon in the forensic world.
Yes.
Where there is different opposing views from psychologists and psychiatrists. Mm-hmm. And from that dialectic, truth is revealed. Mm-hmm. Of course, there has a lot to do with the lawyers, and has to do with the whole, system, the judicial system. But that dialectic and cross-examination of symptoms and perspectives is what creates a more clear clarity of truth. But that's actually interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I got to send you a couple of really good clips. I'll awesome. Send them to your LinkedIn or email, but they're very cool.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's one more question I want to ask you. It's like a new thing that's kind of going on. And I think you being from Chicago, you've heard of it, but psychologists' right to prescribe medications. What do you think about it, and are you for it or against it?
It's a really good question.
How do you feel about it in general?
Well, it's mixed. My feelings are mixed. One of my feelings or instincts is that the reason psychiatrists have for a time at least retained that we're prescribing the medications.
And nurse practitioners, right? And PAs can also prescribe?
And PAs can. is I in my perspective, you have to have like a holistic view of the organism, have a like good medical understanding mm-hmm. of the different medical systems. Who are you going to refer to? Who are you going to? And in a way, because psychiatric presentation is not only starts and ends in the brain, it can be arising from different areas. It could be arising from an adrenal problem. It can mm-hmm. be arising from a problem with your cortisol. It could be arising from the what we call the HPA axis or the hypothalamo-pituitary yep. adrenal axis. And that, these are the main, some of the main glands we have. It could be arising from that imbalance. It could be arising from dysautonomia. It could be arising from a problem in the nerves or the neurological problem. And therefore, without going to an exhaustive list of what it could be arising to, it's just there is so much nuance yeah. to so much causal chains that in my own anecdotal opinion would be unless you went through a deeper understanding of those of the clinical system and a deep understanding of the different organs and what do mm-hmm. they do and the interpretation of the labs, then it would be also almost like a reductionist approach to divorce yeah. psychiatry from medicine and say, well, it's just these are psychiatric manifestations. Let's target them this way and not look at holistically at the body. In the contrast, there is a huge shortage yeah. Of availability of providers. There is huge waiting lines. There is difficulty mm-hmm. of accessing care. And so there, you know, there's always that, you know, two and four pros and cons, and reality is not black and white. So I can't say what I would wish for in an ideal case scenario. What I feel is that both have pros and cons, but I feel that my own anecdotal belief is that psychiatry is a process that is not divorced from medicine. It is part, an integral part of medicine. And therefore, and the psychological factors can affect other medical conditions. And in fact, we have one of the diagnoses in DSM-5 called that. Therefore, I really think that a holistic view of the organism, the holistic view of the presentation of the patient is important.
Now, through my knowledge too, I think obviously for them to be eligible, I think only 5 states are doing this, and I think Illinois is one of them, where you got to get your doctor in psychology, and then after that, you need to get a master's degree in psychopharmacology, and then go through a certain amount of hours of like an internship. And only then would you be, again, qualified. Now, again, a lot of people's like point of view is, like, is a master's level in psychopharmacology enough to, again, be prescribing people medications when you just mentioned, like, there's so many factors you need to take into consideration?
Yeah, and not to discredit, I mean, the psychologists are very well trained mm-hmm. and so much aware of so many layers that sometimes a psychiatrist is not even aware of when it comes to, because of the merit of the hours they spend yeah. with the patients. But I am not aware, to be honest, Jacob, of the nature of the training they have to go through. So I don't want to overgeneralize right. or simplify or be, you know, biased in my approach. So maybe I'll read about it more in order to yeah. really figure out what are the trainings that they have to go through in order to give an informed answer.
No, I hear you. Definitely. And my mindset is just insane when I think about all like the knowledge a doctor needs. And like, I was super excited in grad school to take psychopharmacology. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love that class. So I got the book, right? Yeah. And just the first 2 chapters in a psychopharmacology book, my head just exploded with just all the knowledge, the dopamine, the receptors, all the different kinds of receptors yeah. and how the drug, just 2 chapters, my mind was just blown. And that's one book.
Mm.
And to think what doctors need to know, it's impossible for me to obtain all that knowledge. It was insane. Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
But holy cow.
Yeah, no, it's an endless process of learning, Jacob. Like, I'm still learning every day, honestly, learning from my patients, learning from reading, learning from the most up-to-date evidence-based treatments, learning from the research studies that are being done. It's an endless process of learning, and it's endless process of, you know, renewing myself, renewing the ideology that I have. And of course, you have to have a basis. And that scaffolding was provided by the medical school, the understanding of the receptors, psychopharmacology, the understanding of the different systems and how they interact with each other, and then you start refining this knowledge and even deleting some of the past knowledge and renewing, updating the model that you have of reality, updating the model you have of your psychopharmacological approach.
Yeah, I remember my project. I think I did my project in that class on opioids and oxycodone. And I just remember, like, there's like these, oh God, these three main opioid receptors, like they were like Greek, I think, Latin, like my pi, or I don't know, but it was
mu receptor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how it, for pain, it actually doesn't get rid of it. It slows down the receptors, right? Going throughout your body, the afferent and efferent receptors, or the fibers.
Yeah, afferent and efferent. Yeah, there's lots of, neurology is a complex system, and it's, but I love your curiosity about it.
Oh, yeah. It was fun. It was a fun class.
Yeah.
Yep. Again, Bashil, I had a blast having you on the show. Before we close everything up, I gotta ask you though, when it comes to your career, what type of goals do you have for yourself or the field? And let's say the next 5 years, do you plan on doing like a project or writing a book? What's on your mind on that?
So one of my avocational interests is further understanding of, you know, we're all talking now about, I'm sure you've heard, large language models. Like ChatGPT and the advent of the AI and how to integrate that with the medical system. And I've been working with a team that is trying to disambiguate learning, and meaning understanding the learning transactional system, utilizing one of our core emotions in life, which is called epistemic emotions, or the emotions that we are using to learn. You know, there are affective emotions like anger, sadness, but then there is epistemic emotions, which are the curiosity. And epistemic means that endeavor when you're learning. So curiosity is one of them. Surprise is one of them. Let's say that something is incongruent with what you know and information, then you're surprised a little bit. And and confusion is one of them. You're trying to learn something, psychopharmacology, and you're first time you open that book and you're like a little bit confused. You're curious, but then that curiosity led to confusion. Or your curiosity led to surprise, where you're like, huh, this contradicted what I'm thinking. That's is not congruent with what I'm thinking. So utilizing that epistemic emotion model with a knowledge transaction system, where we are trying to simplify an understanding in what we call knowledge nuggets, just brief snippets of informational pieces. Let's say that this podcast, for example, can be cut into multiple small slices. And one of the slices that people loved and understood and felt of high value can be represented in a small bit, where it's easily to transact between people in order to optimize learning. But not only that, utilizing an AI system to create for you a learning pathway utilizing those small snippets is what we are trying to approach with utilizing the AI technology and the AI facilities that we're using, me and the team we have.
Wow, that sounds so interesting. And
I'm advising in this company, so we're hopeful, fingers crossed, and we'll see how it goes, Jacob. But thank you for asking.
you have my support 110%.
One thing that I would advise, if anybody has any questions that it comes to the psychiatry world because of symptoms that they are facing, challenges that they are having in their life is to go through the normal routes, which is to try to connect to a provider and to not have that stigma or fear. It's so common that you would go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and they would tell you, hey, you just need therapy. Or listen, these are changes that are normative for your age and are things that you might need some social support for. So I don't have that idea that visiting a provider means equal medication, especially when it comes to psychiatry. It can be equal to therapy. It can be equal to multiple things. So I'm just inviting people, whoever has symptoms, there's no reason to be, you know, suffering and going through the to connect with a provider and to try to get the care that you need and the appropriate channels. Yeah.
Well, again, Bishoy, it was a complete and absolute honor having you on the show. I had so much fun learning from you. I had a blast.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jacob. I really enjoyed it too, and I appreciate you having me.
I again want to thank Dr. Bishoy for being an awesome and amazing special guest on my show. I truly had a blast and learned so much from him. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support, and just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org. I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Calmigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone, until next time, have a good day. Bye.